Dozens of researchers, locations, firsthand accounts went into the encyclopedia of haunted places. And we'll be back with Jeff Belanger in a moment and talk about it on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey, what is legend tripping?
Legend tripping is actually a kind of a geeky insider folklorist term that's been around for years, but more an insider term. But I think it's something that we've all been doing. Legend tripping is simply walking where the legends walked. It's going to those cemeteries that are said to be haunted, standing where Bigfoot was said to walk, or UFOs were allegedly landing. That's what legend tripping is, and I think that's the draw to the masses. That's what people are watching on television. That's why what a lot of paranormal conference goers want to do. They want to go on the Queen Mary and go down in the cargo hold where, so many people perished during World War II, and they want to stand there just for a little while and then go back to their lives. It's not quite paranormal research, but I think it's what talk to any paranormal researcher, and I'm sure that's what got them into it to begin with. They heard the stories. They wanted to see for themselves. But taking it one step further, it's also talking to the witnesses, and that's really what this is about, the oral tradition, the sharing and communicating of the ideas of the firsthand accounts of these legends and letting them grow, letting them expand, and opening them up to other people to also experience.
There are people, Jeff, who would pick up Encyclopedia of Haunted Places and they would make a vacation time by going to these different spots. They love doing stuff like that.
Yeah, that's still growing. I mean, you hear about paranormal cruises where people are booking cruise ships that have, paranormal lecturers on them.
And then the ship comes back and there's nobody on.
Right.
And then we've got they're gone.
We got another book to write. That would be great, unless I was on the ship. Then it wouldn't be so great. But yeah, no, that's what so many people are doing today. I get emails all the time, and I wish I had time to reply to all of them. But I think they're looking for a paranormal travel agent. Hey, I'm going to be in, I'm going to be in Chicago. Where should I go? Where should I stay? There's so many places: the haunted bed and breakfast, the hotels, the ghost tours that you can take. The city of Chicago has 5 competing ghost tour companies. 5.
That's huge.
I know. That's amazing.
That's a big city, but that's still a lot.
Of course, but it can support 5 different ghost tour companies. I was just there last weekend, and I just think that's amazing that it's that popular. People are in Chicago. Hey, let's take a ghost tour and go to these various hotspots. And so it's still growing, like you said. Like all of our numbers have shown, it's something that people want to do. And I think that's the special part of it. I don't think, even if there was a way to do this, I don't think people would opt to get a ghost installed in their house. That you want that to be your safe haven.
Unless it's Casper, right?
Right, yeah, right. And or me. I think I might like to get a ghost installed. But for the most part, people want to leave the safety of their home, have this experience, and then take that experience home. Not the ghost, just the experience. That's legend tripping. That's a little bit lighter than paranormal research. It could lead to paranormal research, but it's what I think intrigues most of us.
Do you get involved too in things like poltergeists, episodes that just don't seem to be as friendly as a traditional ghost hunt?
All of it interests me, George. I'm working with various parapsychologists, things like that, because what's happened is I've got this resource. I've got the website. One of the things we're doing for Dr. Barry Taff is a very extensive ghost experience survey where we've already collected something like 1,200, surveys. This is an 80-question detailed survey, and once he gets to around 1,400-1,500, we can start to do something with that data. So that's one of the things that I can help with is to bring people to get data that academics can do something with, other researchers can do something with. And yeah, I hear about the poltergeist cases. I hear about some of the darker stuff. And boy, sometimes your heart just breaks because there can't be anything worse than believing your home is plagued with something that you can't do anything about. I mean, if anyone's ever had termites or bugs or whatever, and you call an exterminator, there's a process to take to get your home back and get it safe and secured and clean. With ghosts, or worse, something dark or something that seems to be, especially attached to a person, God forbid your child, it's way worse. And the sanctity of your home has been violated. People who've ever had a break-in who've been robbed can relate to this, where it just every part of your home just feels violated and dirty. That's one of the things that people go through, and it eats away at your sanity. And they need all kinds of help. And I hear about those stories, and boy, you know, something needs to be done. And thank goodness that there's people out there like the paranormal researchers all over the world that can help with that voluntarily. I mean, the overwhelming majority of them that are helping with that, because it's academics don't seem to be focusing on this, and neither do the scientists, which is a shame.
Are there some regions in this country, specifically in the United States, because we're growing all over the planet right now, but are there some regions in the United States, for example, and or Canada, that seem to be more haunted than other spots in those countries?
I don't think so, but I do believe there are places in all over the world that treat the subject a little differently. And as an example, here in New England, where we've got so many historic buildings, I think we're a little more matter of fact about our ghosts than, say, you know, in the southern parts of the country or places like Texas, that, you know, when a building gets to be old, you know, I'm stereotyping here, there's of course exceptions. A building gets to be 40, 50 years old, they tear it down and put up a new one. So there's kind of a different way that people treat historic properties and thus treat these legends. And so in some parts of the country, you kind of don't talk about this stuff. In other parts, yeah, it's haunted, so what? You know, and I've noticed that, you know, New England, we talk about it. California, a little more esoteric, you know, a little more new agey with the beliefs, you know, that it's spirit, it's this, it's that. Whereas, you know, in Canada, you know, they certainly get plenty of their ghosts too, dating back to War of 1812 and so many other battles and things like that took place all over Canada. I think it's the people, not the location, that treat the subject differently.
What do you think of Bigfoot and UFOs, other demons, where people somehow try to tie them into ghosts? I don't think so, but what do you think?
I do think so. That's the thing. I do think so, and here's why.
We agree to disagree. Go ahead.
And here's why. Because in certain cases, like take old hag syndrome, for example, where a person goes to sleep and they wake up in the middle of the night and they can't move. It's been called temporary sleep paralysis. But with old hag, you wake up, you're paralyzed, you can see your bedroom environment, and you see something coming towards you and sitting on you. Well, depending on what books you read or movies you watch, you may say, that's a spectral attack. That's a demon. I was under attack in my prone state. Or maybe it was kind of a gray glowing figure. Same exact phenomena, different person who said that was an alien abduction. Same phenomena. And it's the perception of the witness that interpreted it completely different than the other person. Or the skeptic who said, oh, sleep paralysis. I woke up during, you know, a deep sleep state when my body was naturally paralyzed, which happens, and I was having a hypnagogic hallucination that I eventually shook off. Three different people, three different interpretations of the exact same phenomena. Who all will wake up and swear, you know, on a stack of Bibles, it was an alien, it was a demon, or it was nothing. It was just a dream. And so in that respect, yeah, I think there is a tie between the aliens and the ghosts and the Bigfoot and everything else. It's the interpretation of the witness.
When some people think that they may be dimensional, these creatures or UFOs, I'm kind of the kind of person, Jeff, I'd like to know that UFOs are physical. They're coming from another planetary system.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, Bigfoot was always here. You know, it's just a creature that was never discovered. You know, those things to me are real. They're tangible. You can see them. You can touch them. Once they start getting into, you know, the possibilities of other dimensions and travel, which are all possible, they're all possible, to me, though, it's a little more difficult to understand and comprehend.
I'm with you, George. I wish it was that simple too, and it may be. Let me throw that out there. It may be. You know, I've seen some photographs and I've talked to some people that have seen very tangible craft that didn't do anything supernatural. It was just there. It may have landed. It may have gotten close and then zoomed off, just advanced. You know, well beyond us. And yeah, you would say, okay, well, that's probably just a physical craft that came from somewhere else, from a civilization that's beyond us in technology, which isn't really hard to grasp considering, you know, science has taught us that some galaxies formed millions of years before ours and some millions of years after ours. So why not? But, you know, boy, maybe there's something else afoot as well. And you know, the Bigfoot mystery, we have to listen to the skeptics sometimes. Why haven't we found a dead one yet? Now, we know that maybe they're scavenged. They're so rare that maybe they're buried. There's so many possibilities. But, boy, you just want to find one, don't you? Just one. Remember Georgia?
That's it.
Last summer, it was about 3 seconds. I went, all right, finally. And then you thought about it and said, no.
Then we found the costume maker.
Right, I know. And then you said, something stinks in Denmark, man. But I know. But we're still waiting, and we're still looking, and we should keep looking because the reports come in, and I don't believe people are liars. I'm sure some of them are, and I'm sure some of them are delusional and crazy, but not all of them. And so many really good, credible people, police officers and government employees and airline pilots, these people are not all lying, and they know what they saw. And you trust your senses, I trust mine, and they trust theirs. We need to listen.
Let's talk about some of these spots in Encyclopedia of Haunted Places. You touched on criteria in the beginning. Let's go into it a little more in depth, Jeffrey. How did you pick the spots?
Yeah, well, in some cases, like I said, it's almost like I like to liken it to, the classic rock band. You got to do the classics. And, Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky is one that somehow we forgot in the first one and definitely wanted to make that up in the second. It's an incredible place. Have you been there?
No, I have not.
It was a place to die. This was a place for tuberculosis victims to come and get the only treatment they could, which was fresh air and try to offer some comfort. But it was a place for so many that it was just the last stop. And thousands of people died here, from this horrible disease and were quietly removed. Well, the building then became a geriatric center and then was closed down and abandoned for many years. And when you go there today, with the exception of a new roof, it's got the look in every way. And I mean, I've been in creepy places before and felt nothing, but there's something about this place. It's all around you. And it's so rare that I have an experience. I think I've had three, and one of them was here. One of them was at Waverly Hills, where you walk down these hallways and you can secure it. You can see there's only two ways down an entire wing. And I was only with two other people. And all of a sudden, we look down, and all three of us say, "Do you see that shadow? A person just poked his head out of what, fourth door down on the left?" And when you have two other people say, "Yeah, fourth door down on the left," and you run down to the fourth door down on the left, there's nobody there. And nobody got by you. No one went back the other way. And you scratch your head and you say, "Okay, all of us saw that," and our first impulse was somehow someone got by us, but they didn't. And the stories just pour out of this place. All the time, consistently, people are having these encounters with shadowy figures moving down these hallways, all kinds of things. And it's just become such a paranormal hotspot. Now, the folks that own it allow people to tour it. So it's one of those rare places where you can go and have this experience. You can stay overnight. You can tour it during the day and things like that. And so, such an active haunt where the stories come out again and again and again, the legend is still very strong. Why? Well, because it must be active. We can almost turn this into a mathematical equation, and that's one of the places that was just a dream night. It's one of those you're running around going, "Did you see that? Did you hear that?" And you get all excited about this subject all over again.
Did you find any stories where true tragedies occurred, and that the people doing the investigating got scared to death?
Well, not literally to death, but yeah, sure. I mean, people get scared all the time. I mean, I know, I think a lot of us want to have that experience, but under just the right circumstances. And I think a lot of us aren't quite ready when it does happen. You want to see it, you hope to see it, but you don't quite expect to. And you get out into one of these locations, maybe it's a battlefield. And I remember talking to someone in Georgia in the name of the mountain is escaping me, but it was the site of a last stand for the Confederate Army as Sherman was pushing down through Georgia. And they said what they assumed was a Civil War reenactor walked up to them and nodded. And that was it. Didn't even say anything. Nodded and walked by. And as the group turned around, he was gone. And there was nowhere to go. It was an open field. There was nowhere that he could have hidden. And they ran. They said, "We panicked. We had this profound experience and panicked, the experience we always wanted." And there it went. So, I guess you always have to be careful what you wish for, but it does happen. Sometimes we're not ready.
Was that Kennesaw Mountain?
Yes. Thank you. My goodness. That was it. Yeah, that's right.
So I study your stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate that. No, it's good to have backup, you know? I mean, there's a lot to memorize.
Oh, there's too much to memorize.
Indeed. Yeah. But these places are all over, these hot spots, and they're not just battlefields. They're not just old sanatoriums. There's theaters. And sometimes, you know, the spirit of the theater is something that I think we all tune into. And in some cases, not even death, or maybe one, you know, not even tragic, maybe a heart attack. But theaters, I don't know if it's theater people, if it's the dramatic, you know, folks that love this, they love to know that there's someone in the audience watching them, right? Even during rehearsal, when they know no one's supposed to be there, that legend pops up all over the place. Canada, the United States, the phantom that watches the rehearsals and is the fan even after death of the theater. These are wonderful stories that tie us together and tie us to our past.
Is it safe for people to visit these spots?
For the most part, some of them, of course, can be dangerous because they might literally be condemned. But I believe it's safe. And some people might warn that maybe there's something dangerous lurking that might try to get inside of you. I haven't had that experience. However, if you're a spiritual or religious person, it just makes sense to say a prayer, to do a quiet meditation or whatever, to prepare yourself before going into one of these locations. It's just because this is a spiritual endeavor. It's not just a thrill-seeking, you know, legend trip. It is also, you can't remove spirituality from it.
No, you can't. You can't. Jeffrey, we'll pick some spots when we come back from this break. I'd like you to pick some of your favorite story spots that we'll talk about. I've been to the Haunted Queen Mary a couple times. And during the daytime, you know, it feels like you're on a ship.
Sure.
At night, it's kind of weird. I mean, you begin to hear strange things, and there's something going on that ship.
Yeah, no, we were there. Remember, that was a few years ago. Yeah, no, it is a special place, full of history, and yeah, especially when you get down into the belly of that boat late at night, and it's warm and the metal's expanding. Yeah, that ship talks. That's for sure.
What creates a ghostly visitation for a non-tragic place?
Okay. Now, I think in that case, you might be looking at something that we would call a residual haunting, or some people call it a stone tape theory, where an event took place and it's somehow imprinted in the environment. And for some reason, some of us can pick it up. Now, that tends to be non-interactive. So you might see the same scene that just plays over. It'll describe the same thing. You know, the woman walks down the hallway and then she disappears. She's wearing a red dress. She doesn't even look at you. And it's always the same act, the same thing again and again. The idea that a magnetic tape records that. Well, maybe stone with a high degree of iron or metal might have magnetic properties that record events for some reason, or a ship made of metal down in the bowels somehow gets magnetized from the engine or whatever and is imprinting these events in the very environment. There's so many theories, and boy, these legends help us explore those.
Absolutely. Where do you get the book, by the way, Encyclopedia of Haunted Places?
Well, you can pick it up on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your favorite local bookseller.
Are you still taking new stories from people, new locations?
Yeah, well, you know, I've got a big old file here that I'm always happy to pop leads into. You know, this one just came out, and I'm sure it'll be a few years before we do the next one. But, you know, I don't rest very often, and I don't take vacations. So there's always another book in the works. And if it's not for this, it could be for something else. So I'm always happy to hear from people that have ideas. In fact, while we were talking, people were emailing me. So thank you very much. It's always appreciated.
Absolutely. And you're doing an internet television show too, right?
Yeah, 30-odd minutes. Boy, that's more fun than I should be allowed to have.
That's a great time.
Yeah, I think it's okay to joke around with some of this stuff, and that's what we're doing. We're having fun. We're making fun of ourselves, but we do, of course, at the end of the day, take the subject seriously, and it's just been a real ball.
Super. Well, Jeff, we're going to take a quick break, but what I'd like you to do during the break is pick maybe five of your top places, haunted places, and tell us the stories of what may have occurred there a long, long time ago. And then next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll take ghost stories and questions for you. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Jeff Belanger right here on Coast to Coast AM. Let's pick some of Jeff Belanger's five favorite spots, Jeff. Tell us what happened in these locations.
Well, I've picked out a diverse group here. I want to start in New England with America's Stonehenge, also called Mystery Hill. This is a spot in Salem, New Hampshire, that's believed to be about 4,000 years old. It's unlike Stonehenge of England, it's where you look at this at Stonehenge in England and you say, my God, how did they do that? This is more, you look at this place and say, why did they do this? There are four alignment stones that are carved at the top of a hill that's covered in rock. And the alignment stones seem to line up on sunrises and sunsets of solstices. And the last time it would have lined up perfectly was about 4,000 years ago. Now, what shakes archaeologists to the core is that it doesn't seem to be Native American. They just didn't build these kinds of things in this region. It could possibly be Celtic, which would, of course, predate Columbus by thousands of years coming here. No matter what, it's been a spiritual place right from the get-go. And there's a table called the sacrificial table that looks, it's got a carved ridge around for collecting blood, which has been seen in other cultures as well, and a spot where it would be pooled and then drained, and it's big enough for a human. So the thought is human sacrifice has taken place here, and today it's considered one of the most haunted hotspots of New England. And people have seen strange glowing lights, which the Irish might call the will-o'-the-wisps, others might call them orbs, but these glowing balls of light have been seen all over the top of this hill. It's been a spiritual place for a long, long time, and still is. And so people have these ghost sightings. Was it Wampanoag Indian? Was it Celtic? Some even think it could have been Phoenician. You know, there's so many different theories, but it's an enigma, and it's a haunted enigma that that people are still scratching their heads about today. Great spot to visit, great outdoorsy location. Another location that I think is great is Old Idaho Penitentiary in Boise, Idaho. There's something about a prison, George, that, you know, this is not where we put our favorite people in society.
You're right.
You know, these are bad folks. This is death row. You know, people, you know, often spent their last days there. Some were murdered in prison. And, of course, it's surrounded by what? Stone. You know, stone. The stone tape theory, the idea that this stuff can record these tragic events. About 13,000 prisoners went through this place. 215 of them were women. The prison closed in 1973. It was one of these kind of frontier prisons that, of course, a necessary evil in our society. And a place where there were hangings and there were executions right up to the end. Today, it seems to be haunted by something kind of dark. You know, people have been pushed, they've been touched, they've been scratched, especially around the where the gallows were once located. And it's the kind of place that we're still drawn to, not only to see what prison life was like, and you have to understand too, this place was especially bad. The stone made whatever the conditions were outside worse inside. So if it was cold outside, somehow it was colder inside. You know, these stones held the cold. If it was hot outside, it was almost like an oven to the prisoners, eating away at their sanity, making them just miserable, which I'm sure led to more than one fight, more than one murder. You know, pushing people to the breaking point, and all of that. I do believe all of that gets recorded into the actual environment, and we still pick up on that. But what seems to still be there might actually be intelligent and interactive, because it's actually attacking people, you know, and leaving marks. So that's you know, that makes it a little bit different. Another location that I think is unique down in Mexico, the Museo de las Momias, the Mummy Museum in Guanajuato, Mexico, is a cemetery that goes back to the 1870s. And what they did was kind of innovative, and hopefully this idea doesn't catch on anywhere else, although it might. When people were buried there, you had to pay a tariff to keep your loved ones buried there. If you couldn't pay it, then they would be dug up. And
you mean like every year they had to come back with a little more pesos?
Exactly.
Huh?
That's right. That's exactly right. And if you couldn't afford it, the bodies would be dug up and placed on display. And then they figured out that this was a draw, so they were charging people to see the bodies.
They were making money coming and going, huh?
It didn't matter. They were going to make money, whether you left them in the ground or not. And what they noticed was because the land was so arid and dry, there was a natural mummifying effect. So the bodies are incredibly well preserved. There's still facial hair. There's still, you know, I mean, it's not that pretty to look at, but they are preserved bodies. And there's over 100 on display, 118 to be exact, that are still on display to this day, where you can see exactly how they were buried. These are the people that couldn't afford to, or their families couldn't afford to keep them in the ground. And there's a universal taboo about disturbing places of the dead. I mean, you don't do it. You don't disturb King Tut's tomb. You don't rob graves. It's a big taboo. It's a no-no. And maybe that gross injustice is what leads some of these people to believe that it's haunted today, that maybe the disturbing the mortal remains of these poor folks in Mexico have left them feeling, you know, angry and seeking some kind of acknowledgement, and thus the haunting, thus the people seeing the spirits, seeing the, you know, the hearing the footsteps and hearing the voices still murmuring all this time later. Really, really quite a place. Another place. This is a location in France, in Paris. This is one of my other profound personal encounters, and I've only, like I said, three.
This has got to be an old place. I can tell now.
You know, some people go to Paris and they run right to the Louvre or the Musée d'Orsay or
the Eiffel Tower or something.
Right? Yeah, the Eiffel Tower. No, not me. I go to the catacombs where you're 30 meters below the city, where they've hollowed out the ground 300 meters. I'm sorry, 300 kilometers have been hollowed out beneath the ground when they were digging all this great limestone to build the city. But a big problem was coming up around the 1700s. Paris was getting very dense. It's getting to be a very big city. Buildings were getting heavier, and they were hollowing out the ground underneath. It was a recipe for disaster. Another problem was that they put their cemeteries on the outskirts of town. But after a few hundred years, the outskirts aren't the outskirts anymore. The city has grown around the cemeteries, and they're enclosed, and there was no more room for the bodies. So you've got buildings collapsing into the hollowed out ground below, and you've got cemeteries that are literally overflowing with bodies. They're not even being buried anymore. And so they tried to solve these two problems by closing down the tunnels and moving the bodies below into them, the bones. And so you've got these catacombs filled with bones. And I went down there. I'm 6'2", and there's plenty of spots where I had to duck to keep walking. And if I stretched my arms out in both directions, I'd be touching the walls with each fingertip. And you walk through and you see a doorway that says, Arrête, c'est ici l'Empire de la Mort, which means stop. This is the Empire of the Dead. And you walk through and you're greeted by 6 million human skeletons. Oh, man, it takes your breath away. You know, just rows and rows of bones stacked up. Jeez. All around you. Yeah, I mean, and shapes, too. There was crosses made of skulls. There were Valentine hearts made of skulls, arcs, and all kinds of other intricate designs. And again, we've disturbed a place of the dead. And as I'm walking down a hallway completely alone, a narrow hallway, I saw a shadow the size of a man move from the right side to the left and back again. And I looked down at my feet where my shadow was, and I looked all around. There was no one else down there. And, you know, wow, it really took my breath away. I said, and what was worse is that's the way to out. You know, I had to keep going that way. But that's one of the things that really startled me. You've got a century of people being moved down there. And you wonder, you're like, wow, you know, people have disturbed the place of the dead for all of these folks. But they've put them in this really beautiful yet macabre pattern. You know, there's a retaining wall of leg bones and arm bones with skulls placed in there in a very articulate way. They weren't just thrown in a pile. I mean, this took great care. And it's very humbling. As you walk through about a mile of these tunnels surrounded by bones, you start to realize this is the only way, I think, that they could still show some respect. Because
how bizarre.
This isn't the only catacomb in the world, of course, but this is a big one in Paris. And, you know, this is how they showed respect. There's no way to know who's who anymore. You've got noblemen mixed with peasants and great-great-grandfathers, you know, 60 generations of Parisians down there. And it's so humbling as you get near the end. It goes from, you know, giving you the willies to, you know, this very, you know, powerful feeling of history, of, you know, these people had to give up their final resting place in order for the city of Paris to grow. And, of course, it's haunted. Of course, we tune into that and feel it. And when I got to the end, I had my bag with me, which had my cameras and my audio recorders and things like that. And I went up to the top, and there was a security guard that asked to check my bag. And I said, you know, usually they check you going into a place. And then I said, oh, my God, I realize what you're doing. You're looking for bones. And he pointed to a table behind him that had four or five bones on it. And he said, that's from this morning. So still people are disturbing this location, which is that's the tragedy.
I was going to say, if people desecrate a location, Jeff, does something happen? I mean, does a haunting get violent?
You know, I don't know if I believe in luck or juju or whatever, but I I do believe if you think you're cursed, then my friend, you are indeed
you're
cursed.
Absolutely.
And as a Boston Red Sox fan, we know all about curses up here. we know sometimes the only way to break them is with a good pitching staff.
I've got a friend who is a Yankee fan that you two would really hit it up because I love Boston, by the way. I was raised there for many summers when I was a kid because my mother was from Fitchburg. He hates the Red Sox. The Red Sox.
We have an understanding, George. It's not personal. It's business. You know, I mean, it's an obligation when you live up here. You have to hate the Yankees.
And by the way, not that this is a sports show, but the Tigers are playing the Twins Tuesday night, and it's the playoff game.
Right.
We'll see what happens.
I know. It's exciting times, isn't it?
Give us a little. But you know, I got a great audience in Minneapolis, and I'm from Detroit. I'm darned if I am and darned if I'm not.
That's right. Yeah. No, that's how it goes. And but you know, talk about superstitions. Boy, athletes, all of them, doesn't matter which team you root for, they are a superstitious bunch of people. And getting back to the curse, if you believe that you've done something to bring on the wrath of a curse, you're cursed because something bad will happen. You'll drop your dinner plate and it'll break and you'll say, "It's because I took that damn bone from the catacombs." And then something else bad will happen and you'll keep focusing on every little bad thing that happens. Whereas if you hadn't taken the bone, you still would have dropped your dinner plate. It still would have broken, and you would have said, "Oops, I'm clumsy. I'll just clean that up." These are the kind of things that really can become reality. They can compound on each other, and as you focus on them, then it's real. It's as real as you believing it's real. Now, whether that can actually be, you know, the evil eye can be placed on someone, probably, as long as they believe it worked. It's going to become a reality for that person.
What if the person, though, giving the curse is stronger emotionally than the person receiving the curse and therefore has that ability to really put a curse on someone?
I'm sure it is. I mean, think about people in your life. I mean, I'm sure we've all had a really overbearing person in our life. You know, hopefully not. Maybe like a romantic relationship or a parent or a sibling that was just so overbearing, mean, you know, or a friend or a colleague that just literally overpowered you in every way and intimidated you. It's kind of like a curse. I mean, people do have power over other people. It's a sorry state. Sometimes by, you know, hierarchy in work or in domestic relationships and things like that. And there's something real to that. And if you want to focus that intent to do something bad, I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can curse, and I'm sure you can be cursed. We're powerful people. I don't think we quite understand all that we're capable of. When you think about this stuff and break it down into those kind of levels, and it's dangerous and it's too bad. I try to keep those overbearing people out of my life if I can. You know, that's something I work toward.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, there's psychic vampires too.
Of course, that's a real thing. You don't have to believe in anything New Age, but there are people in your life that you talk to, and you realize the more they talk, your shoulders start to slump. You're not saying a word, and just all the energy is being drained from you. And they may not even realize they're doing it. And then they go away, and they feel better, and you feel worse. You know, these are not people you want in your life. No fun. No fun at all. But
Jeffrey, you're turned to a lot by, you know, a lot of television networks, this program. You've got a passion for what you do. When they ask you to look at something or they're interested in interviewing you, what seems to be the big topic? What are they really interested in? What are they after?
I think that what people want to know is this stuff real? Is it for real? And my answer is always yes, it's for real. I have no doubt it's for real. What's going on? Now, that I'm still working on, and I'll probably work on the rest of my life. But it's real. It's been real for millennia. Can we prove ghosts exist? No, not to everybody, but it's been proven millions of times over to millions of individuals all over the world who've had an experience that they are certain, that they know they trust their senses, and it's been proven to be real. Same with UFO encounters, abductions. These are people who perceive it as a reality, and therefore it is for that individual. Now, can we convince everybody? No, but I say, look at the resources that the Catholic Church has for the last 2,000 years. Billions of dollars, tons of land, and they don't have 100% market share yet. What chance do I have?
Yeah.
You know, this guy from Massachusetts trying to tell everybody that ghosts are real. I just want to convince myself, and I'm happy to pass on anything I've learned along the way, because, you know, I think other people can add to that discussion. I can gain insight from others, and it's just a great journey that we're all on. Whether you want to take, you know, whether you want to look around or just keep your head down, that's an individual choice, but we're all on it. We're all headed in the same direction. And I think, you know, the more we talk about it, the more we can just really get a full human experience, you know, a full life of, you know, not just going to work and cutting your lawn and paying your taxes, just really living and extending ourselves. So that's what people want to know. Is it real? And yeah, it is. And all I can do is tell you all I know.
Did you ever see the movie Lady in White? You remember that one?
No.
About the little boy who saw a ghost of a girl in a school where he got locked in at night. Great movie. You've got to watch. For you, you'd love, you'd enjoy this one.
I'll add it to my list. I wrote it down.
The Lady in White.
All right.
It's got an incredible ending, and it's kind of scary, but at the same time, it's not. You'll know exactly what I'm saying when you look at it, Jeff.
All right.
It's one of the movies I thought Hollywood finally did a good job with.
Okay.
And didn't distort what a ghost might be. And gave it reason, I think, for existing.
Hey, and you know what's interesting, too? You know, talking about Hollywood and television and things like that, I think, you know, some of these programs are definitely sensationalized, and I understand. I mean, they're trying to entertain. You know, that's the purpose, and we all have to do that to some degree. If you can't captivate people with what you have to say and the content you have, then it's as good as not knowing it if you're not going to reach anybody. But at the same time, I think you can get it right and still reach the audience. I think you can raise the questions that are intelligent and intriguing and titillating and all that other stuff and still reach that audience. And the good news is I know there's a few productions in the works now that I think will get a lot closer to the mark, that I think we'll start to make this, you know, not so much about running around at night with night vision cameras, everybody looking green with glowing eyes, you know, but actually trying to have that discussion and put it all on the table in a more cohesive way. I still have hope, but maybe I'm just a dreamer.
Is a belief in ghosts also then a belief in a divine intelligence?
I think it's pretty darn close. If not a belief, it's you're definitely in the ballpark, probably even in the infield, because if we go on afterward, then I think there must be some kind of grand design at work. And if there's a grand design, that would lead me to believe there's a creator.
Indeed. You ready for some phone calls and some stories?
Oh, this will be great. I can't wait.
And what's your email address, Jeff?
People can get me at info@ghostvillage.com.
info@ghostvillage.com. And, of course, we've got the link with ghostvillage.com on the coasttocoastam.com website. You're pretty a prolific writer, but you also did a long time ago, Mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. Classic, wasn't it?
That's actually coming out in February.
Oh, that's coming out too?
Yeah, it's a kid's book. That's a kid's book that comes out in February, yeah.
Super.
Yeah, exciting stuff.
Okay, we'll talk about that later.